Boom.
If you thought 4 hours a day, 1,200 minutes a week was enough, think again. He's the last remnants of the old republic. A sole bastion of fairness. He treats crackheads in the ghetto gutter the same as the rich pill poppers in the penthouse.
Wow.
The clearinghouse of hot takes break free for something special. The fifth hour with Ben Maller starts right now.
The light is flashing. That on-air light is flashing. And that means it is time for another edition of the fifth hour with Ben Maller, because 4 hours a night are not enough, 8 days a week. And we thank you for subscribing to the podcast, for finding it, first of all, listening to it, telling friends about it. The only marketing budget we have is none. We have no marketing budget, but with the way we promote the podcast is to make a fuss about it, get you to tell friends, enemies, we don't care. Anyone that might be able to download the podcast, spread the word, spread the gospel. And I like to say, and I believe this is true, that if everyone listening, if you listening and the other seven people listening, so we have eight people that download the podcast, but if all eight people tell eight other people to listen to the podcast, and then those eight people do actually download the podcast, we've now doubled the audience. We've doubled the market share. It's that simple. It's Maller math, and that's the way we do things. But this week, we start the Friday podcast. I am very excited to talk to somebody who has known me since I was a teenager, when I first started in radio, and has been very kind to me over the years as I navigated my way as a radio reporter. I used to hang out in press boxes with this gentleman, and he has a new book out. And I said, you know what, Ted, I got to promote this book. You're a friend of mine. Now, normally I don't do these book interviews. I don't normally do these book interviews, but it's really just telling stories. That's all it is, telling stories. And that's always a good podcast. That's solid podcasting, broadcasting in general, telling stories. And so the name Ted Sobel, if you're in Southern California, you likely know who that is, a staple of the LA media scene. He worked in news radio at the iconic KFWB as the sports director for many, many years. Currently, he is nationally known as the studio host for the Sports USA Network. I think that's what it's called. But he does the NFL and college football, and I believe they've got the NHL rights now on radio. And he is called Minor League Hockey. He lived in Wisconsin. Did some University of Wisconsin hockey broadcast back in the day. Worked for the Mighty Ducks. He's been all over the place. I've known him for a very long time. He's got a new book out called Touching Greatness. And Ted has had a very interesting life. He has met pretty much everybody who's anybody in the sporting world, but it's not just about sports. And more importantly, for our purposes, Ted, you are part of the FSR Alumni Association. We were briefly teammates. How long? It's been a while. How long did you work? It wasn't long. How long did you work at Fox Sports Radio, Ted?
I was there, Ben, at least two shifts. No, seriously. I was there for a handful of months. I don't remember exactly, but I left around Thanksgiving after I did some things in the summer. So it was just a handful of months there. It was just bad timing, that's all. And plus, I was only working the very, very late overnight shifts. And when I say overnight, you were long gone. So, you know, even the sun was a rumor at the time. And that just didn't work into my my body was saying, what are you doing? You're too old for this.
Yeah. That's what I try to listen, Ted. And now you've had prime radio jobs, right? I remember you on KFWB, and you were like the primetime guy and all that. But
23 years, but who's counting?
But the overnight, though, Ted, that's where you really get your hands dirty in the overnight.
And you are insane to be doing this all the. I would have been laid out in a casket decades ago.
Well, we're all headed that way, one way or another. But
just don't want to do it too soon, you know what I mean?
Yeah, we wanted to delay that as long as possible. So we have known each other. You have known me, Ted, since I was a teenager. Since I was
a
teenager. Full disclosure, I would actually like to thank you because there were some guys that kind of gave me the cold shoulder when I started, and I was out covering some Dodger games and stuff around the town when I was 19, and you were not. You were pretty cool all along. And
I love the way you say that. Not too cool, just pretty cool. Hey, remember, you sort of earned the cold shoulder at times, too, so let's be honest with the folks out there.
Well, I disagree with that. I do not agree with that position at all. I was just because I got lost one time at Dodger Stadium, and I didn't know where to go, and I followed somebody, and they turned out to be the biggest asshole that I had ever dealt with. But other than that...
Is that me?
No, it was not you. It was somebody
else. Thank you.
I feel
better already.
No. I had not been in the bowels of Dodger Stadium before, so I'd gotten lost, and I figured, well, there's another reporter, so I'll just kind of follow them, and they'll know where to go and get out of here. And then it turned out to be the one guy who hated me the rest of my life because of that that activity. But you have covered the L.A. sports scene. I mean, you've seen and done it all. I know you've got a book. We're going to talk about that. But
what's the name of the book again?
Oh, it's the I think it's called Touching Greatness. Is that right?
Very
is that,
good. You have a great memory. Very good.
Look at that. I got it right in front of me here. But no, I started in the 90s. You were covering the games way before that. And so, what kind of paint the picture for those that are wondering? How much did it change from the 70s, 80s to the 90s there? And obviously today it's a totally different situation. But when you were covering like the Dodgers in the 1970s compared to covering the teams, you know, the years before, what was it like then? Was it it obviously was a lot different. There wasn't the internet and all that stuff, so kind of paint the picture what that was like.
Well, first of all, not just the Dodgers, any team, they wanted us there. Now they don't even want to know we exist, so it's a big difference. You know, just the fact, remember, food was free to the media then because they absolutely needed us in the house. Remember, I tell this to everybody, and people never think of this, but it is the most important thing when it comes to promoting sports from a media standpoint. It is the only business, and I mean, you talk about movies, you talk about anything else, that gets free 24/7 publicity, and they don't have to spend one penny. Not one penny. And it's the only business on the planet, probably in the universe and maybe every universe. So they wanted us there because if we're there, we're giving them constant free publicity by the second. Now, if you were a shoe store owner and you had somebody from the L.A. Times, for example, say, I'm going to come over to your place every day at 6 o'clock, right around the time you close, and just find out how your sales went and talk to your people and what kind of patrons did you have today, blah, 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 and we're going to write a little story about you every single night. I would send a limo to that person. And that's who we were for the sports, for any club, whether it was college or pro. So, again, now they don't need us as much. But in the 70s, Ben, I started in 1973, my first credential. It was to a point where if you had access to the room, you were wanted in there. Not by every player, but by the organization. And it was so different. It was accommodating. It was, hey, what can we do for you? Now it's, hey, how can we get you the hell out of here and maybe never give you a credential again? It's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah, and you one of your good friends, and I was reading in the book, I knew you had known Paul Olden a long time. I didn't realize you met him in school, which you talk about.
Yeah, LA City College.
Yeah, in LA City College. And for those that don't know, Paul Olden is the public address announcer for the New York Yankees. But for me, he's the Kingman rant guy. He's the guy that recorded for posterity's sake the Tommy Lasorda rant when he flew off the handle over Dave Kingman getting out. And I've heard stories, Ted, that there's other rants that in those days that weren't recorded from Lasorda. You were there covering the Dodgers when Tommy was. Is that true? Can you confirm or deny that there were other rants that did not get saved that were actually better than the Kingman or the Bavacqua?
Well, let's put it this way. First of all, I love the way you said, is that true? You said it a little bit like Healy, but that's okay. Jim Healy, for those of you who don't know, a classic legendary radio voice in L.A.
And my
anyway,
hero, Bob.
That one is a classic because of the way it happened, because of the timing of it, and because I always loved that Tommy used to say, I never used an F word in my life, and that was like, oh, you mean in the last 5 seconds? You know, Tommy was, he was a classic. He was unbelievable. You never knew what mood you're going to get him in, except for he was always in one specific type of mood, and that is, I want the attention mood. And he got it. That time, I'm sure he didn't do it intentionally. He just lost it. And, by the way, in a future volume of Touching Greatness, there will be a chapter called What's Your Opinion of Kingman's Performance? And I got the whole story, exactly what happened and why it happened that day. But, yeah. No, I never heard any specific one. I mean, I recorded him 1,000 times. He'd throw an F-bomb in there, of course, whenever he was in the mood, but not like that. I don't recall anything being that would have stood out to this point. And remember, in those days, there were times when maybe radio was not in the room at the time, so that would be a good question to ask a newspaper writer who covered them regularly in the early days, because they may have had a few really classic rants, but nobody was there to record it, so it didn't really matter.
Yeah, and what I remember from covering Lasorda, I was there at the end, his last few years when he was managing the team, so he'd already established himself, and he was this bigger-than-life personality, which he always was, but having won the World Series a couple times and having success and all that. But I remember, Ted, when we would go into the locker room to interview him, and if the Dodgers had won, we'd get Jolly Happy Tommy. That would be bouncing off the walls. He was in his office there. He'd be standing up in front of his desk and want to talk to everybody. And then when they lost, he would be downtrodden behind his desk and usually eating some kind of food that he had in his office and spitting all over the microphone. I remember having to clean my microphone because Tommy spit.
There was a lot of garlic on my microphone for years. garlic and red sauce.
it was wild. And of course, Lasorda selling it back in the 80s, right? He sold pasta sauce and then also he had a diet program that he was.
Yeah, well, later he also had his own wines too, you know, which was pretty neat stuff. But that was much later on. Look, Tommy, if you didn't smell garlic, then Tommy was out of town. I mean, it was always classic to walk into that room, into his office after a game. You get the closer you got to him, the more you could smell his breath. And you're right. There was something about him eating slowly in front of us. After a loss, he seemed to be, I'm going to enjoy the food more than your damn faces in this room. That's the way it always seemed to be.
Yeah. Now, I do want to get to the book, Touching Greatness, and you got some of the stories about all these, you know, all the great characters that you've covered over the years being around the game. I am jealous, though, Ted. I'd love to write a book someday, but then I found out how much time you spent on this. You said this is a three-year project. How many hours do you think would you estimate that you put in? Because you didn't have a ghostwriter, I saw. This was all
I'm Casper the Friendly Ghost, unfortunately. No, wow. You know what? I don't want to count the hours because if I do, I'll probably shoot myself. I want that time back. All I know is that, and I thoroughly am prideful about doing this because it's not an easy thing. But remember, it depends on the kind of book you're writing. I did something about literally decades of my life from the beginning and trying to remember stuff that I wanted other people to know of. And I've told these stories forever and everybody said, well, you should write a book one day. Well, I finally have. And it got to the point where there were so many things I had to look up. It took hundreds of hours, no exaggeration, of research because I wanted everything to be 1,000% accurate. The date, the time, what exactly happened, if it had anything to do with the story. And that's what took as much time as just writing itself. I'm talking hundreds of hours.
And how often was your memory a little off? You have a very good memory, but I've read
studies. What was your name again?
Exactly. But I read studies like that. What we remember and then like the timing is usually off a little bit. Like version of what we remember is not completely right. How accurate was the memory, the mind of Sobel, looking back at your life and the things
that
have happened?
That's a damn good question. You know what? It was actually very good. I'm a little surprised myself. I took some notes about 20 years ago. And I thought, okay, if I'm ever going to do this, let me write down a few things. And I literally had several just plain white sheets of paper where I would scribble a little note on just to remember something and throw it in a file and put it in the drawer and totally forget about it. And I literally forgot about it. No, my memory's good, but I couldn't remember where the notes were. And I finally found them, and it's like, oh, yeah, here's the book, all these scribbles. And that's pretty much how I started. It was not some organized, great, perfect outline or anything. It was like, well, I want to write about Don Drysdale. I want to write about Lasorda. I want to write about Jerry West. And it was this, whatever that little specific note was, put on a scribble sheet and put away. So, but no, my memory was actually very good, but I wanted specifics where it would really, because once you look it up, you see a box score from 50 years ago, it brings back memories that you would never, ever recall.
Yeah, and I've known you for many years, but there, obviously I don't know your entire life story and all that. And
you do now.
No, I now I have the full volume, which
whether
is interesting.
You like it or not, you do.
And it is appropriate. I mean, at the very beginning here, Ted, you go in, and I didn't know that Jim Tunney, the legendary referee, when you were in high school in L.A., he was your principal at Fairfax High School. That is crazy. Did you know? Was he an official at the time he was the principal? Was
Of course.
Yeah.
Oh, he was the dean of NFL refs, and he was our principal. Absolutely. We used to talk. He would stop in the hallway in high school, and every, you know, us sports guys, other people who weren't into sports didn't even know what the NFL was. And remember, it was not the NFL like it is now. It was not the national pastime like it is now. Everything was baseball then, and everything else was okay, whatever, if you enjoy it, good for you. It was so different, and he would stop, and us sports guys would like to get him, like during a lunch break or whatever, nutrition, and he would stop, and we'd just all be talking, hey, but you covered the Packers-Bears game yesterday, you know, that kind of stuff. So absolutely, and I ate it up because I was totally into it more than most, and he invited us, and I was fortunate to be one of them, and I basically wouldn't allow a no answer to the fact of if you might even be too young to remember Sports Challenge, the old Dick Enberg game show. Do you remember that at all?
I've seen clips on the internet, but it's before my time. Yeah.
That's what I thought. Well, yeah. I'm from a different generation.
That's all right.
It was a classic show. I mean, the first show they had Joe DiMaggio and Jerry West and Elgin Baylor and Duke Snyder, and it was unbelievable. And those are the guys. Right. Well, I was invited by Mr. Tunney, as we called him, of course, then, and Jim now, and that he's a friend, and I think he's 92 years old now, and he's just a phenomenal guy, and he's one of the endorsers of the book, by the way, and he was the one who opened the door to get my publisher. So that's a big deal, what he's meant to my life. But at the time, Jim invited me, as I almost insisted on it, to be one of six guys that from Fairfax High in L.A. to sit down and be one of the pretend superstars on the show. It was before the first airing of the show, and they had to do the angles and check out the video clips and make sure everything was working perfectly. So it was the practice show that I was on. And I sat in Tommy Hendrick's seat, former Yankee, and he was there for the first game. And then after that, we got invited to the actual taping of the first two shows. And it was just, that show was unbelievable. I mean, it was because they had, you know, almost everybody who was anybody was on that show, including Jackie Robinson was on that show.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing, you told the story in the book about when you were a kid meeting Ted Williams at a store somewhere. He was a Sears. Yeah, he was.
Yeah.
Was he signing autographs or something like that? He was promoting.
Yeah, Ted Williams. This is like 1961 or two.
Yeah.
He had just retired, and he was there to promote everything in those days, Ben. For a couple of years, maybe 5 years, I don't know, he signed a contract with Sears around the time he retired, and everything said Ted Williams on it. Forget baseball. I mean, we're talking like he was a big hunter and fisherman and stuff like that. So the entire sporting goods department at Sears, it said the Ted Williams name and his signature was on everything. It was Ted Williams barbecues. It was Ted Williams whatevers, anything there. So
yeah.
My father heard he was going to be there, and this was in Hollywood here in L.A., and he says, I want to take you to go meet Ted Williams. And I said, that'd be great. And I was in Little League at the time. So we went there, and as we're going through the store, My father looks at his watch. He goes, you know what? It's running a little late. And we look over, and Ted Williams is standing up, and he's starting to walk out like he was done. And so whatever he was doing, he was finished with his shift. And when he was finished, he was finished. And my dad hustled over, and he was not exactly an athlete. And he hustled his ass over there and said, Mr. Williams, please stop for 1 second. I want you to meet my son, Teddy. And I hustled with him, and he looked down. And he goes, oh, it's very nice to meet you. Another Teddy ball game. He shook my hand and walked away. He wasn't rude. He was just leaving, you know.
Yeah.
And to me, that was the first touching greatness moment. Even though he didn't sign an autograph for me, I didn't ask him. I mean, he was literally walking out the door, and he was very nice, but curt, you know, real quick. And I looked at my father and said, this is like the greatest thing of all time. I just shook Ted Williams' hands. And
yeah.
That gave me that feeling like, you know what? I don't want to hang out with Joe Smith on the street corner. I'd rather hang out with Ted Williams. And that was the start of things, and touching greatness has evolved decades later.
Look at that. And that's cool, because we have heard stories that Ted's been gone for a while, but we've heard stories that he had been very aloof at times. So that's cool that he at least stopped to acknowledge a kid in the series.
Well, the aloof athletes, we've all been around them, and you probably can write a book just on the aloof athletes. You know, that would be a good one for you, by the way. Write that down.
There you go.
That could be 35 volumes. One of the most aloof guys in the history of sports, maybe the history of the universe, is Joe DiMaggio. And I have a great story in the book how I snuck into Dodger Stadium after a Martin Luther King charity game in 1970. And I just had a great, wonderful interaction with Roberto Clemente getting autographs at the team bus as they were leaving. And it's probably the greatest compilation of Hall of Famers on the field at one time in this one game that's almost forgotten in the history of baseball. And it, when the game was over, it was late in the afternoon. I was a teenager. I wasn't ready to go home, and I just wanted to hang out at the Ravine. And there was no security guys or anything in those days. I just wandered back into the stadium, looked around, and thought, you know what? It would be sort of fun to see if anybody's left. I started wandering downstairs, ended up at the visitors' club, at the old visitors' clubhouse at the Ravine, and the door was slightly open, and I looked inside, and there was an old man sitting there in his shorts and a tank top, and I looked a little closer. It was Joe Effin DiMaggio sitting there all by himself, staring at a wall, doing nothing. And I knocked on that giant, if you remember the old visitor's locker, I'm sure you do.
Yeah.
That huge metal door when we walked in. And I knocked on the thing, and he looked up, and I said, excuse me, Mr. DiMaggio, can I get your autograph? And instead of him being a jerk, like I've heard he could be many, many, many times, he was in just a, you know, really easy, relaxed attitude. Yeah, sure, kid. And then he said, what the hell are you doing here? How did you get in? And all that kind of stuff. And he signed my book, my program and my autograph book. And we had a little small talk. He was very nice. How's school? All that kind of stuff. And then he said, sent me on my way. And that was the end of it. But that was another neat time. Nothing like sneaking into the Ravine. And Joe DiMaggio is there. And I say it's the only time DiMaggio ever signed his autograph in his underwear, including Marilyn Monroe.
Be sure to catch live editions of the Ben Maller Show weekdays at 2 a.m. Eastern, 11 p.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
Well, that's great, because when I was in high school, I tried to get DiMaggio's autograph. We'd found out he was appearing in San Diego at a card convention. The National Trading Card Convention was in San Diego. So a buddy of mine found out what hotel DiMaggio was, like a lot of the people were staying there. So I went down with some friends to try to get DiMaggio. We were stalking the hotel, sitting in the lobby.
Of course you were. We all did then when we wanted autographs, right?
Yeah. So I wanted to get DiMaggio's autograph. And so I sat for, as I remember, now it might not have been this long, but it felt like hours as a, you know, sitting in the lobby and security tried to get us out of there, and then we came back.
Of course
and
they did.
Yeah. So finally, DiMaggio was like the white whale. Yeah, you know, I mean, how could we? You know, it's elusive and all that. So I remember DiMaggio. We saw him get off an elevator with like two other people, But he was supposed to, we had it all planned out in our head, Ted, that he was going to walk right through the lobby and out to the front where the cars were, except he made a right turn and walked to a side door, and he walked through the kitchen, and we weren't allowed back there. He snuck. I saw like a side shot of DiMaggio on like the back of his head as he walked through the kitchen to get out of the hotel to avoid
us. Yes, and you felt like an idiot sitting there waiting for hours, of course, as we all did. But you got your little brief view of Joe DiMaggio, and if it was today, you'd have your cell phone taking pictures. You say, there he goes. It's sort of like the Zapruder film after a while.
Exactly. Now, I've not read the entire book here, but the one, you know, certain things that stand out, Ted, and we actually have a similar background in the fact that you went to LA City College, I went to Saddleback for radio and stuff, and the chapter 10 about Radio 101 in my DNA, that, if you're a radio kind of nerd, radio geek, we have a lot of people that listen that love radio and people that do radio well. Yeah, exactly. Even though it's a podcast, a ripoff of radio, live radio, but you go into great detail there, and you got to go as a college kid. You got to go watch a broadcast of Dodger post game program. That's pretty cool. Was it your professor that was the guy that was doing it? Is that right?
Well, no. I mean, all that stuff we did it on our own, and that was Olden and me, and we would go to games and literally sit and practice play by play. But I think one of the things you might be referring to was the 1974 World Series. Well, I was already out of LA City College by then, by about a year, and I was actually credentialed to the 74 World Series. That's how long ago that was. But no, and what we would do is we would hang out in the press box area and wait for them to leave their notes, you know, whatever their reads were and their assignments and all that stuff. They would leave it on the desk because it was just trash when the game was over, and we would pick it up and read it thinking that we just found gold as we're trying to figure out how to be broadcasters, and we just got Vin Scully's notes from his NBC broadcast with Joe Garagiola. And so that's what we would do, and then we would read it and prep and use it during our fake broadcast when he's sitting in the stands calling a game every damn night. So it was a blast, but we would do everything on our own. I mean, literally, we went to like maybe 50 Dodger games a year, some Angel games too, not as much because it was a drive to Anaheim, and then we'd go to the Forum and we'd do 30 or so Lakers games and Kings games. And we would have those notes from NBC, from the Dodgers, from the Lakers, and bug the hell out of the PR guys, and they hated our guts after a while. Well, some of them actually got it, and they knew that what we wanted to do, and we were sincere. We weren't just messing around. And others used to be like, can you guys get the hell out of here? You're college students, and you're bothering us. And so it was fascinating. But, again, it was whatever it takes, right?
Give me notes.
And if you're 18, 19, 20 years old and you're trying to get into the business and you got Vin Scully's read on the air, I mean, please, I got to have this.
Did you keep any of that stuff? Do you have any of those?
You know what?
Notes?
I didn't. I have one thing that I kept. The 1974 World Series notes I still have because it was in a World Series MLB. You used to have it like a little folder, and it would just say World Series on it or something, and it was the game notes. And I stuck some of the whatever we took off the table, I put inside there and just put it away and totally forgot about it. I found it about 5 years ago. It was sitting in a folder somebody gave to me. It said Al Raboski's name on it.
That's random.
And so, how's that for old?
Yeah.
And he was the best reliever in the biz at that time. So there was some St. Louis stuff and then the 74 World Series. And we actually had Sal Bando, if you remember that name.
Yeah, I do.
He was an all-star for the Oakland A's in 1974, third baseman. This is how it was, Ben, how it's totally different. I don't think you ever lived this because I think it was gone by the time you showed up. We were literally in the A's dugout 20 minutes before the start of the World Series game.
Wow.
Because there was nobody there. I mean, nobody cared. Right?
That's crazy.
So as the guys are coming off the field, we got Sal Bando to come on our fake pregame show before the World Series game started. He walked over. He was a guest. We got him for like two or three questions. He was fantastic. He was a really nice guy. And then we said, well, okay, and we'll be back with the start of game one after this. And then we went upstairs and practiced in the stands.
That's outstanding.
Is that a classic?
That is a great story. So I was there a little bit in those. You know, it started to turn over around the time I started, unfortunately. So a lot of that stuff went away. And
note on the Sal Bando thing. That game is the famous game when Reggie Jackson hit the fly ball to right field, where Joe Ferguson ran in front of Jimmy Wynn and made one of the greatest throws in the history of the World Series to throw a guy out at the plate. Do you remember seeing the video on that thing?
The toy cannon. We should point out here, touching greatness, that both you, and we mentioned Paul, you know, the Yankee guy, and he did play-by-play. Yep. Both you guys, you did play-by-play. You've done play-by-play for college and minor league hockey and a bunch of stuff over the years, and now you're a network. So both you guys made it. And you would hang out in the upper deck at Dodger Stadium doing mock broadcast, the very top?
At Dodger Stadium, we were on the field level. We sat in the same seats almost every night. We got to know the ushers at the Forum at Dodger Stadium. And if nobody showed up with a season seat or a regular seat, they let us sit on the last row behind home plate in Section 5, 105. And we would sit there, and it would be... it would be next to, because we needed this, next to an electric plug, so we didn't have to use our batteries because we couldn't afford them for our cassette player. So we could plug into the wall, you know, which they use basically for the cleanup crew afterwards. We used it up. We said, hey, this is great. We get to use Dodger Stadium electricity for our cassette recorders. And we sat in the same seat almost every night, and the same seats at the Forum as well, because in those days the games weren't sold out. So we sat up high at the Forum. But again, right by the place where we could plug in, and it was our office, and people knew us up there. The regulars up there used to turn off Chick Hearn and Bob Miller and listen to us do the play-by-play, and we ate it up. It was a blast.
Well, I was going to ask you that, because I've heard stories back in the old days, at Dodger Stadium in particular, like Vin Scully, everyone was listening to Vin call the game. It was like you didn't have to have headphones on. So when you were doing the play-by-play in the back there, Were people receptive, or were like, hey, shut up, I want to hear what Vin has to say? What are you kids
doing? Well, that's a great question, and there was always, every once in a while, you get somebody like, hey, I paid my $4 or whatever the hell it was in those days to come to this game. But almost everybody, I guess we sounded good enough, they enjoyed it, and they could see that we weren't just screwing around. I mean, we were trying to be as keen a broadcaster as possible, and just learned game after game after game. And almost everybody was nice to us, and a lot of them say, yeah, as soon as we come, we turn the radio off, we just listen to you guys, and they're having a blast. And by the way, nobody was wearing headphones in those days. Headphones didn't exist. Those are earplugs. But
All right. Well, fine. You called me on it. So now another thing that I had like a light bulb moment here, because you had a chapter of hanging out with Elgin Baylor, and we both have a mutual friend who passed away a few years ago, Dave Stone, who worked at Fox Sports Radio, who I remember we were at his service. Like, to me, he was the biggest Elgin Baylor fanatic I had ever. He knew everything about Elgin. He used to tell me, you know, Elgin was better than Michael Jordan or Kobe Bryant or any of these guys. And
by the way, it's true, but go ahead.
But I didn't see Elgin. I only knew Elgin as the Clipper GM. So
that's the problem.
Yeah,
people didn't see him, so they're all dead now. What can I tell you?
But you saw him, and you became friends with him, right? You knew him.
Yeah, I stalked him. You stalked Joe DiMaggio, but I got to hang out with Elgin for 50 years, and Joe, you're still waiting for Joe to sign your damn book. So it's a big difference. But when I went to Fairfax High, I moved into a neighborhood that I had no idea. When I was playing B and C basketball in school. And one of the guys my first year says, hey, you moved into a neighborhood where Elgin Baylor lives. And remember, he was playing at that time. This is 1968. I'm losing track of this here. So he was still the superstar. I mean, he was Michael Jordan before Michael Jordan was a sperm, I always say. You know, I mean, it was that simple. And so when it got to the point where I realized, if Elgin really lives here, I got to find this guy. And I used to hitchhike up the hill, because it was a very steep hill above Sunset Boulevard, and I didn't drive yet, so I had to hitchhike to get home, and it was too long to walk. And one day, in the story, in the chapter, Della Reese, the late great Della Reese, the actress singer. She used to pick me up regularly and drive me half the way home. She lived up that hill, and she was really nice to me. And one day she dropped me off, and I'm walking the rest of the way home, and I look over as cars are coming by, and I could have sworn that's got to be Elgin Baylor. I couldn't believe it. He was driving an old giant Buick, a brown one, and I'm staring at the car thinking, I got to find this car. And that was my whole life. The next several weeks, where the hell is this car? And I walked up the hill and sideways and every which way. I was running into rattlesnakes. I was past houses just trying to find. And one day, it was only two blocks away from me, but it was a hidden cul-de-sac that he lived at the end of the cul-de-sac. And he had to continually walk up this grueling hill. And there was a house with that car sitting right there in the driveway. And I said, I just found gold. This is the greatest thing. Okay, now what the hell do I do? What am I going to do? Yeah. Knock on the door and say, hey, I'm here. I'm your new best friend. You know, it's great. I found his car. Who cares, right?
That's a tough one.
Anyway, I did knock on the door. And Mrs. Baylor, Ruby, his first wife, answered the door. And she was so nice. And she says, Teddy's, he's taking a nap right now. And remember, this during the season while he was playing. So I said, is there any chance? She goes, you know what? Come back tomorrow about the same time. He should be, everything should be great. They were very neighborly, all right?
Yeah.
So it was
great.
So I came back the next day. I was so excited. And I write in the book how nervous I was that if I was my age then, I would have keeled over. It would have been all over. I would have had cardiac arrest within a second. I could feel my heart pounding out of my chest. I was so nervous. And then finally, I got up enough nerve to hit the door again and she answered, hold on one second. Elgin came over, and he looked down at me, and, you know, I'm about 3 feet tall at the time. And I'm not that much taller now. And he looks down at me, and he goes, hi, I'm Elgin. And I'm looking at him like, no shit. I never would have guessed. Anyway, so it was fantastic. And he invited me in to his he had this trophy room where he had the MVP and all these Seattle University and unbelievable trophies everywhere. And this was towards the end of his career, but he was still playing. And I was about to leave the house, so I spent about 15 minutes with him. He was really nice. And Tommy Hawkins once told me, the former Laker and his one-time roommate for a long time, said to me, I'm surprised Elgin's not usually like that, but I think maybe his wife was a good influence on him in that department. So he spent some quality time with me, and then basically said, hey, it was nice to meet you. Now good luck to the rest of your life. And as Mrs. Baylor was about to close the door, and I mean literally, it was almost closed, and saying, thank you, it was nice to meet you, and, you know, good luck, I turned around. A light bulb went off in my head, Ben, and I said to myself, this can't be it. There's got to be more to this than that. And I quickly turned around, excuse me, Mrs. Baylor, would it be possible for you guys to take me to a game sometime? I don't drive yet.
Oh, that's great.
And she looked at me like I was insane and didn't know what to say. And she says, well, I don't know. I have to ask Elgin. Well, why don't you come back another time and we'll bring it up. And that's all. Oh, thank you. And I walked away, and I'm laughing, running back down the hill to my place, thinking, they just invited me back. I'm on my way back. And I did, and they did, and they started taking me to games. And I used to hang out with their kids at their house and shoot baskets in his backyard. And the one time that Alan, his son, invited me over, said, hey, let's shoot some baskets. Elgin was there practicing his free throws, and I thought I was going to die.
That is
so
funny.
Anyway, it was just an incredible time, and you can't do that anymore. You have to get through the 16 security guys with the machetes and the machine guns and you know all that stuff, and get over the moat, and good luck.
Imagine a kid today, Ted, going up to LeBron, because Elgin was like the LeBron of his days. Hey, LeBron, go up to LeBron's house in Bel Air. Hey, LeBron, I want to hang out and see your trophies. Good luck.
Yeah, can you come up? Can you take me to the games from now on? It's like, no, those days are over. But it wasn't only amazing to me, but because it's decades later and the world has changed so much, I think it's sort of a timepiece there where I could say, this is the way it used to be, at least potentially. Not everybody went over to Elgin Baylor's house, I hope.
Yeah,
but you know what I'm saying. You had to have beach balls to do it in the first place, and then it just worked out so great.
Well, and I remember, Ted, you brought Tommy Hawkins' name up, and I love Tommy. He told me a story one time when he was on the Minneapolis Lakers when they came to L.A., And he said in the early days, the Lakers, it's amazing to think about this because I'm surrounded by Laker historians that love to brag about the Lakers and all this. But when the Lakers moved from Minneapolis, basketball was not very popular, like pro basketball. And the Laker players, Tommy said, would have to go out, you know, the day of games, they'd ride around in the back of trucks or flatbed trucks and try to get people to come to the game that night. I mean, that's insane to think about now, considering how popular the Lakers were. And imagine if you had players today, Ted, if you told, again, LeBron or these guys, can you go out and promote the game that night so we can sell some tickets before? I mean, it's insane to think about. But
it's totally insane. I mean, as a matter of fact, they would say, talk to the union. I'll get back to you in about 20 years when I'm retired. You know, not one person would do it. And but you had to do it. I mean, remember, these guys, a lot of them had jobs on the side. This was not big money in those days. So this was their seasonal job. And then they go back being a lifeguard in a car wash or something after that, you know, until the next season. So it was really a lot of amazing stuff in those days. And I used to go to the sports arena, not your Clippers sports arena, but when the Lakers played there. Yeah. And it was a dump when it was new. I always thought the place was a dive. But I was there and it was half full for a Lakers game. And it was just a different world. The media wasn't what it is now, or forget now, even 30 years ago. There was no important game of the week that was on all the time. It was just so different. So, and of course, early on when they moved to L.A., I mean, you had to establish the fact that, hey, we got a professional basketball team here, and you guys, if you don't read the sports page, you're not going to know it exists.
Yeah, so, it's wild.
Hawk used to talk about that, where they drive up and down, and it was also sometimes, I think it was a convertible, and they'd have their little megaphones out and say, hey, it's a 7:30 start tonight at the sports arena. The New York Knickerbockers are in town. And I love those stories. I think it's great because it's impossible to imagine today, but it's the way it was.
Yeah, it's wild. So now you're a great storyteller, Ted, which is wonderful. Radio guy and all. But if somebody's still undecided, Ted, right now listening to this and this far into this podcast,
I feel sorry for them.
Well, I know, but you've covered L.A. Yeah. Obviously, mostly L.A. sports, but you were in Wisconsin for a while. At one point, you've traveled all over the place. But why? Tell the guy, sell the book, Ted, because I want to see this do well. I'll tell you why in a second. But touching greatness here, somebody in Sheboygan or Punxsutawney or Springfield, like why would they want to read a book that's mostly about you know Elgin Baylor and L.A. type sports? Why would they want to buy this book?
Well, first of all, it's not just L.A. It happens to be my memoir plus a lot of other stuff. But there is a lot of people in Sheboygan, and not that I hang out there, so I don't know for sure. But if you're listening to this in Sheboygan, you're probably fascinated by stuff that goes on in Los Angeles. That's why we have too many damn people, because the second you come here and visit, 10 minutes later, you're living here, and we got 4 billion people in one lane on the freeway. This is part of the problem.
Yes.
Remember, I used to live in Wisconsin, and there'll be a future volume of Touching Greatness with some stuff about my Wisconsin days, but there's also a football chapter right now with a lot of Aaron Rodgers and Bart Starr, because I grew up a Green Bay Packers fan as a little kid when they were great during the Vince Lombardi era. So I talk about getting a chance to meet my idols, and that's a lot of what this book is about. It doesn't matter if you're from L.A. or from Mars. There's a lot of, hopefully it'll be inspirational stuff, but at the same time, just make you smile stuff, because it's the kind of thing that the average person who might be a sports fan walks down the street, and if they got a chance to meet Ted Williams or Joe DiMaggio or anybody in between, Koufax, Drysdale from the other era, or Kobe and Tiger Woods from this era, you're gonna love it. I mean, it's a moment you'll never forget. Well, I write about many, many, many moments I never forgot in that vein. And there's also music in here, too. I talk about being around, there's a chapter called Laurel Canyon Days. And I was there in the late 60s when I went to Fairfax High School. I lived not far away from Laurel Canyon when it was the place. It was the capital of music in the world. Everything was based out of Laurel Canyon. You know, the Byrds and the Beach Boys and everybody were living there. And the bands like the Eagles and all those guys were formed there. and I have stories about, I break a couple of stories on how two of the songs from the Eagles, New Kid in Town and Tequila Sunrise, were written by around the guy that is a former L.A. Kings player, Gene Carr. And Gene gave me an exclusive story that's something he's never told anybody else before, and he just thought, he felt comfortable with me, and it was great. He's a super guy. And he told me the history. New Kid in Town was written about him when he got traded to L.A. from the New York Rangers. And he and Glenn Frey became extremely close friends. Glenn Frey of the Eagles, who passed away a couple of years ago. And Glenn Frey, you probably remember seeing him. He was always at Laker games and Kings games and stuff like that. He was a season ticket holder. He's a big sports fan and loved to play golf regularly. So yeah, a lot of that stuff is in the book, and it's unusual stuff. I mean, you just don't see this anywhere, and I just happen to live through it. And again, I've told people stories forever about this and that, but I go into, literally, there's a, where were you when JFK was shot? Well, I know where you were. You didn't exist yet, right?
That's true, case. Yeah.
But
yes,
a lot of people still ask that question who are around today. Where were you? It's one of the events of all time, of course, negative or positive. And it got to the point where, you know what, I remember that moment like it was yesterday, and I thought it was an interesting thing to recall, and I tied it in around my favorite baseball player, Don Drysdale, who was just a phenomenal guy and became just an icon around here, and the Drysdale-Koufax holdout of the 60s and how much that meant. So there's a lot more than just because it's L.A., but I talk about Tiger Woods and covering him at the British Open at St. Andrews and Kobe, his first game that he played, or his first, I should say, his first season that he played, and his last game of his first season was his air ball game when he shot four air balls in the last few minutes, and he looked like the worst player who ever lived. I just happened to be in Utah that night because I was announcing a minor league hockey game the night before and the night after, so I got a credential to cover that game, and I was there. I ended up winning a golden mic for the damn thing, and I talk about that story. So, look, there's just tons of stuff. It's not just L.A. It's mostly icons that I discuss, and even Vegas, the Rat Pack era. I mean, even Ben Maller knows who the Rat Pack was,
yes,
even though they were
yes,
all 90 years old by the time you showed up.
That is true. I remember Sinatra occasionally going to a Dodger game when
yeah,
I first
course,
started.
During the LaSorda era.
Yeah, exactly. But
you might even have seen him a few times over there.
I did.
Surprised, right?
I did, yeah. It was wild. I remember the last time I remember him showing up, there was a rumor in the press box that he was going to be there, and then at that time he was bigger than life by the end of his career and stuff.
Yeah, but exactly.
It was like a statue
showing up or something.
Exactly.
He couldn't sing like he used to and all that kind of stuff, but he's Frank Sinatra, so nobody cared.
Exactly. And I also love, and this is how I consume books, Ted. You know, I don't read too many books, but I love the fun facts and did you know, because, you know, those are right in my wheelhouse, little nuggets that you can, you know, kind of wrap your mind around. One of them that stood out to me in Touching Greatness, I did not know this. My mom was a huge Sandy Koufax fan, used to regale me with stories about Sandy Koufax and all that. But he actually owned a hotel in that Laurel Canyon chapter.
It was on
there.
Santa Monica Boulevard, right down the street from the Troubadour.
He owned a little kind of Route 66 hotel type thing. Is that crazy?
Yeah, it was literally like a motel, Motor Inn kind of a place. It's sort of a cheapo place, but for a while his name was not on it, and then it became the Sandy Koufax, whatever it was, I can't remember anymore, something Inn. It was only for a few years, maybe 5 years or something like that, but that's where the bands used to stay and party and do whatever the hell they did back in the 60s, who played at the Troubadour and the Whiskey A Go-Go. Some of them were there, including Jim Morrison was a regular. He used to stay at that hotel all the time, and I have a fun interview in there, a little quick Q&A with Robbie Krieger, who was the guitar player for the Doors, who was also a golfer, and I've known him for a little bit for several years. He's a really good guy, and he loves talking about the old days. And he gave me the answer. I said, did you guys know that Sandy Koufax owned this, and what would Jim Morrison have said? And it's in the book. I mean, when's the last time you read anything with Jim Morrison and Sandy Koufax's name in the same damn sentence? It ain't.
Yeah.
It's never going to exist again.
No. It's a tremendous – I really stuck with me as a fun fact.
Be sure to catch live editions of the Ben Maller Show weekdays at 2 a.m. Eastern, 11 p.m. Pacific.
Hey, I'm Doug Gottlieb. The podcast is called All Ball. We usually talk all basketball all the time, but it's more about the stories about what made these people love their sport and all the interesting interactions along the way. We talk to coaches. We talk to players. We tell you stories. You download it. You listen to it. I think you'll like it. Listen to All Ball with Doug Gottlieb on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So now, full disclosure, we need this book to do well because I need the second edition of Touching Greatness because, Ted, yeah, one of the cool things about knowing you, you worked with one of my idols, one of my inspirations to get into radio, Jim Healy, and you knew him and you were around him. And it's not in this book, but you've told me that if there is a second book, that if this does well, I believe it will do well, Ted, that you're going to write an entire chapter about Jim Healy, my radio hero.
It's already written, by the way. It to you. I don't know if you got a chance to even glance at it yet.
But. No, I'm trying to get people to buy the book, Ted, so I want you to get the second book. So
I appreciate it.
Yes, exactly.
But I did write it already, and maybe I sent you the unedited version. If you haven't listened to Jim Healy, and you're too young, or you just didn't know of him, or you certainly, if you're not from L.A., there's a good chance you never heard of him. There's stuff online, and I'm sure that you could pass people, send them to links and whatever
to listen
to these shows. There's a million of stuff out there. He was unbelievable. But I started when he started. When I was in college in 1973 is when he started doing his shtick on the air that way. And Paul Olden, the following several months after that, worked at KLAC in L.A. In the news department there while he was still going to college. It was like they found an opening there, and it wasn't just an internship. It was actual job in the news department, and he started getting this sound off the newsreels for Healy to use, and he started using them. And one of the early things was there was a sound effect album, one of many, many, many volumes, where there was a sound effect of a man falling down the stairs. You can hear them hitting the stairs, each stair, and every time he hit it, he goes, all right, up, hey, do you remember that at all, that sound?
Yeah, I do.
He would use that when, let's say, for example, in those days, let's say Ali punched out Joe Frazier, and he went down, and he would play that sound effect as the guy falling down and getting the crap beat out of him. Well, that sound effect came from me, because I heard that when I was a kid on the Dave Hull Show, who was my radio idol as a non-sports radio idol, one of the great DJs in the history of L.A., the Hullabalooer. And Dave used to play that all the time. So when I got into radio, and I forget professionally, when I got into the radio department at L.A. City College, I looked everywhere for that sound effect. I couldn't find it. And we finally went to a library one where they had old albums of sound effects, and I went through dozens of them, and I finally found it. And I didn't know that it was labeled as Man Falling Downstairs. That was the title of it. I mean, it lasts like 4 seconds. We're not talking about a whole album here.
Yeah.
So I found it, and I said to Paul, I said, you got to give this to Healy. I know he can use it a million times. The next night it was on the air, and he used it for the next 20 years. So that was my first contribution to his show. And then I did a thing where when Walt Alston was the manager of the Dodgers, we used to be sitting in the stands doing our practice play-by-play, and there was one game where I was just fed up. Alston was almost literally falling asleep in the dugout. I mean, it was just, you could see his head, nodding off. It was embarrassing. And we had good seats, so I was close enough to tell. And I think he was half asleep when he left whoever was in the game at the time. These guys getting bombed, and we're saying, "What the hell? We're doing our practice play-by-play. What is he doing? How do you not have any reliever? Bring him in off the bus stop, anybody right now. This guy's getting his ass kicked." And finally, he brought somebody in, and Olsen's walking out to the mound after way too many runs were scored. And I stood up, and I yelled, "You're stupid, Alston." And it, because where we were, the hall was right behind us at the stadium. It was this incredible, an echoing sound, and we would listen to our broadcast every night on the cassette tape. And Paul listened back, and he goes, Wow, I shut up. Just happened to be you yelled, "You're stupid, Alston." That came out so good. I'm giving that to Healy. And Jim used that for years. Every time a Dodger screwed up, "You're stupid, Alston." And he would, and that would be me, although my name wasn't on it. He called it, he called the voice of that man the irate fan. And
that's,
he said,
great.
"Now the irate fan is all over Alston again tonight. Boom, you're stupid, Alston." And that was the start of a lot of other stuff.
That's great.
We were totally involved in that show.
That's awesome. And yeah, Jim Healy, there's a bunch of Jim Healy clips on YouTube. There's actually, if you Google the right words, there's a Jim Healy, there's a web page that still exists that has a lot of his old sound bites.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
And there's
some
when Kirk Gibson hit the big home run in 88, and then the following year, remember, that was the last at-bat that he had for many, many months because he had surgery on his, I think it was his knee at the time, and when he came back the following season, I was there that night working for the Dodgers audio wire. You might remember the name Jimmy Pels. You knew him, right?
Yeah, I did. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, so Jimmy ran the Dodger audio wire, and I used to fill in for him a lot whenever he just needed an extra body or he was on vacation. And that night happened to be the night that Kirk Gibson made his comeback, first game since the 88 home run. It's in 89, of course. It's like around, I don't know, mid-season or something. He missed a lot of the early part of the season in 89. So he came back, and he didn't do that much, and the Dodgers lost. So it wasn't a big deal, but the story was he's back. So besides the fact I'm working for whoever I was working for, maybe AP or UPI, getting my 12-second sound bites, I needed something for the Dodger audio wire. So we waited and waited for him. He finally showed up. Never forget, he had the big, giant white towel wrapped around him, and he's just the typical pissed-off Kirk Gibson. He was impossible to deal with. He was a total jerk to most of us on a regular basis. I know he's a lot of people's idol and hero, but if you had to deal with him, he would be off that list pretty quick.
Yeah.
Anyway, so it got to the point where we were waiting for him to give us 5 seconds so we just get a couple of questions. So one of my questions was, hey, I just spoke to Kenny Howell, who was a former Dodger pitcher who was pitching for the Phillies that night. And I ran in there first, got Howell sound. And he said, I didn't have my best stuff, blah, 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 but, you know, figured out a way to win, that kind of junk. So I came back in there and I said, I just spoke to Kenny Howell. He said he didn't have his best stuff. And he went all over. He starts cussing me out. It's a rant that ended up on Jim Healy's show. And there weren't a lot of F-bombs or anything, but there were a couple of little ones, but it was his attitude. It was like, gee, what? It's great to have you back. You haven't played since the big home run, and you're a total jerk to everybody. And Healy was all over him.
Yeah.
And that thing is posted online somewhere. You could find that. And you can hear me ask the question. It's not, again, not as famous as What's Your Opinion, a Kingman's performance. And it's not about being famous. Basically, Healy said, the guy's working for the Dodger audio wire, and he's still ripping it.
That's outstanding. Well, we got to wrap this up there. But the book, Touching Greatness, where can people find it? Is it everywhere? Is this available all over the place? Do you want to direct people to a certain website or just find it?
I want to direct people to Amazon. That's the easiest place. It's also on Coach's Choice. And that's plural Coaches, COACHES, Choice. That's the publisher. And you get it directly from them. But it's on Amazon right now. It is not in bookstores yet. It's very new. Not sure when it will be because that's a whole political thing on how to get your book from a smaller publisher into the bookstore. So it may or may not ever get into any of the big bookstores. Well, that's all to be determined. But just go to Amazon, Touch of Greatness, Ted Sobel. It's right there. And I hope you can check it out for whatever reason. If you're into sports, if you're into music, if you're just into the history of Southern California the way it was in the 60s, I go back and talk about growing up in Culver City with restaurants the way it was, my favorite food then, MGM Studios and how it used to be, and I used to sneak in there, and my favorite shows like Superman and the Andy Griffith Show and all that stuff were all recorded down the street from where I lived, and we tried to sneak into the studios, and it was just a lot of fun stories like that.
Yeah, no, it's a great book. Ted, thank you so much. We'll hang out at some point again. I appreciate it. I'll see you at a game or something. Thank you.
You got it. Thanks, Ben. Appreciate it.